Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. The David and Lucille Packard Foundation for the coverage of fisheries issues, and the Bullitt Foundation. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the future of the last remaining temperate rainforest has sparked a firestorm in Alaska as well as on Capitol Hill. The rise of tourism has made decision makers of forest management take notice, while their search for the best way to sustain wildlife ecology raises questions. Environmentalists and loggers lock horns over legislation to extend a contract for cutting timber in the Tongass National Forest. Check out a garden that feeds a family of five and doesn't have to be planted each year. Sound too good to be true? The technique is called permaculture, which creates an environmentally sound ecosystem right in your own backyard. Earth Calendar visits Tennessee for a glimpse at the rare but flashy Tennessee coneflower, a unique treasure which thrives through drought and flood in Nashville. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. A battle rages in southeast Alaska and Washington, D.C. over the future of the Tongass National Forest. Attorneys representing 200 wilderness tourist businesses have secured a judgment which challenges the way the U.S. Forest Service manages the Tongass. 100 miles long and 50 miles wide, the Tongass Forest is one of the largest in the national forest system. It encompasses the last temperate rainforest and includes hundreds of islands along the Alaskan coast. Spectacular shorelines are lined with huge trees that seem to appear and disappear as the Pacific mists intensify and dissipate. A biological treasure trove, it's home for many species of wildlife, including bear, the Alexander Archipelago wolf, black-tailed deer, salmon, and eagles. Biologists say the small dark wolf is a distinct subspecies, closer to the Minnesota wolf than their larger cousins that live in interior Alaska. It lives on black-tailed deer. Tom Waldo, staff attorney for the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, explains what the lawsuit is all about.
In the 1940s and 1950s, the Forest Service entered into two 50-year timber sale contracts that basically guaranteed these two large corporations 50 years worth of cheap timber in exchange for building and operating a pulp mill that would employ workers year-round. In 1993, Alaska Pulp Corporation, one of the holders of these two contracts, closed its pulp mill in Sitka and laid off the 400 workers that worked there. In response to that, the Forest Service declared that it was a breach of the contract and terminated the contract. When the Alaska Pulp 50-year contract was canceled, we had high hopes that the Forest Service would seize this opportunity to manage the Tongass in a more balanced way, to provide less clear-cutting and more protection for old growth, for fish and wildlife, and for the other uses of the forest, like tourism, fishing, and recreation. Instead, the Forest Service continued business as usual and proceeded to offer all the available timber to other purchasers as if nothing had changed. So we brought the lawsuit, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with us that the Forest Service was required by law to go through a public process to at least consider more balanced alternatives.
The U.S. Forest Service contends that its timber sale program is a bulwark of a permanent and stable economy in the Tongass. The wilderness-oriented tourist businesses argue that economic interests favor tourism.
The tourism businesses that brought this lawsuit are getting crowded out by logging. People don't come to southeast Alaska to see huge clear cuts. They come for the beautiful scenery and to see wildlife and catch fish. As more and more areas are clear-cut, there are fewer and fewer places to go for tourism and more people wanting to go to those remaining places. This is a real concern to the whole region because tourism is much more important to the economy of this region than timber is. Visitor spending is currently over $150 million a year in southeast Alaska and growing at a rate of over 20% per year. It's absolutely explosive, phenomenal growth.
Also an issue is the future of southeast Alaska's fishing industry. Logging, which causes siltation of streams or destroys habitat and water quality necessary for fish spawning, can threaten the sustainability of the fisheries. In economic terms, Waldo says about 2,000 jobs are dependent on logging, while commercial salmon fishing produces 5,000 direct jobs and sport fishing adds 1,200 more. Unlike the wilderness tourism industry, the commercial fishermen which did not join in the lawsuit are reluctant to pick a public fight with the loggers. Liz Cabrera is director of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association, a group of full-time commercial fishermen.
You know, we want to be able to raise concerns that we might have regarding habitat protection, but we don't want to necessarily be labeled as being opposed to having a healthy timber industry in Southeast Alaska. And unfortunately, the issue has become such that it's completely polarized. You can't bring up a concern without being labeled anti-timber. And I think for most fishermen, that's a really difficult label to accept. Well, they don't want to be labeled that because they're just as much dependent on a natural resource, and they really sympathize with what's happening with the timber industry.
Three things are now happening at once which will define the future of the Tongass. One is the review that the court has required the Forest Service to make before allocating some or all of the timber allocated under the first of the 50-year contracts, which has now been canceled. The second is the adoption of a new management plan by the Forest Service. A draft has been published, and public review is underway, which has produced intense debate and controversy from all sides. Pamela Finney, public affairs specialist for the Forest Service, says their recommendation, which includes a smaller timber cut than in the past, should protect all of the competing interests in the Tongass, but not without risk.
The forest supervisors, in choosing the preferred alternative that is proposed, believe that we can offer 357 million board feet of timber a year maximum, and still provide enough habitat for the variety of wildlife, as well as protection for the anadromous fish, which the salmon, which is very important up here, and provide tourism opportunities as well as mining opportunities in Southeast Alaska. They believe that that is the best balance and mix all the way around. It does have a small risk toward wildlife, and it does have some risk in the wood products because it doesn't offer as much as the timber industry would like.
The third factor on the horizon for the Tongass is the proposed extension of the 50-year contract held by the Ketchikan Pulp Corporation that operates a mill in Ketchikan. We hear about that issue in the next segment of this Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or hear any of our last four shows via the Internet. Go to our webpage at www.wamc.org/env and click on Listen to The Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env. Ketchikan Pulp Company executed a 50-year contract with the U.S. Forest Service, which provides that the company will cut specified amounts of timber in the Tongass Forest each year. That contract expires in the year 2004. KPC now seeks to extend the contract for another 15 years, and legislation has been introduced in Congress to authorize the extension. We're joined for an Environment Show debate by Troy Reinhardt, spokesman for the Ketchikan Pulp Corporation, and Steve Kalik, director of the Alaska Rainforest Campaign, a conservation organization. They lock horns over the question, should the KPC contract for cutting timber in the Tongass National Forest be extended? Mr. Reinhart.
Environmental extremists will present you with a false choice between protecting jobs and saving the environment. The extension legislation is a win-win situation. We can have both. The extension bill protects the environment by allowing KPC to spend $200 million in environmental upgrades on our Ward Cove pulp mill, making it the cleanest in the world. In addition, it'll protect thousands of year-round jobs in Alaska. This is moderate legislation that protects jobs and keeps intact the compromise that was the Tongass Timber Reform Act of 1990. This legislation will not change important on-the-ground environmental protection. This legislation does two things, makes KPC environmental leaders and protects jobs. Don't be fooled by the environmentalist extremist's false choice.
Mr. Kallick.
This contract gives one special interest company exclusive rights to clear-cut in America's most beautiful national forest, which is the world's last remaining temperate rainforest. They saw down all the trees in these clear-cuts, destroying wildlife habitat and leaving huge, ugly scars on the land. Worse yet, federal government subsidies pay for this program with $30 million tax dollars every year. No company deserves this deal, but this company has a horrible environmental record. Hundreds of pollution violations, millions in fines, a felony conviction last year, you name it, they've done it. This contract should be ended, not extended.
Mr. Reinhart, in reply.
Don't be fooled by the environmental extremist claims of compromise and balance. The Alaska Rainforest Campaign doesn't want balance. They wanted balance. They would not have the Sierra Club, a group that wants to stop all timber harvesting on public lands, as a major member. If Mr. Kallick really wants to find balance, he should come together with the working people of KPC to help set an example for the future rather than try to steal their jobs.
Mr. Kallick, in reply.
No company in the country deserves special rights to harvest timber like this. We have a free market system that works, and we should let that system work in the Tongass. We don't have to have one company with exclusive rights to access these trees.
We have heard from Troy Reinhart from the Ketchikan Pulp Company and Steve Kallick from the Alaska Rainforest Campaign. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we meet a man who feeds his family with a permanent garden through a combination of biological disciplines known as permaculture. And in our Earth calendar, the once-thought-extinct Tennessee coneflower blooms. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. In Alaska, the question is how to manage 17 million acres of national forest sustainably or in a way which permits all of its wildlife and biological functions to continue. On a smaller scale, a man in the Northeast is demonstrating that he can feed his family from a permanent garden of less than 1 acre using a combination of biological disciplines known as permaculture. While his permaculture garden is in a temperate climate, the method is successfully practiced in the tropics and in arid lands using different combinations of plant material.
From the road, little distinguishes Christopher Robin Healy's house in Lake George, New York. But the small garden in his yard will soon supply nearly all of his family of five's food. The key to its production is a design method called permaculture.
it's a mixture of disciplines. You have appropriate technologies, right? Solar energy, wind energy, water energy. You've got organic agriculture. And it's these different disciplines all woven together to form a mosaic carpet, which is permaculture design. And it's just common sense.
The garden is only about 8/10 of an acre, yet there are hundreds of varieties of plants. Permaculture is bioregional, which means that it can be practiced in all climates, from desert to woodland. In Lake George, which is in a hardwood forest typical to the Northeast, that means growing plants that can take the long winters and will interact with the surrounding plants.
Well, permaculture is a sustainable design science that it mimics nature's design for a place. You know, I come here and nature's design for this area is actually forest. This whole area would normally be forested if people weren't living here. And so what I do is I marry nature's design for the place with human needs by proper planning, proper functional connections between the elements in the system. See, the strength in the system lies in the connections you put between elements in the system.
Each plant in a permaculture garden relies on other plants and animals for survival. What Healy is creating is actually a miniature ecosystem designed to self-reproduce year after year.
What we do is we make harmonious connections between elements in the system, at least three healthy connections. And actually, when you put down three connections consciously, you get about a dozen or 15 more connections after that that you notice in time.
For instance, Healy knows not to plant tomatoes near his walnut trees, since they'll release a substance that will kill the tomato plants. For other plants, the opposite is true. Near an apple rose bush from which he harvests rose hips, he has planted a type of onion, whose scent will throw off Japanese beetles, the rose's main predators. As you look around, you realize no plants are alone. Each plant has a role, either to provide food or to complement those that do. Some plants enrich the soil. Others attract pollinators like bees. And still others repel pests. Healy says this is just how nature works.
Nature seems random, but nature's not really random. Everything's there for a purpose. Everything's created for a purpose. And these communities are like rainforests in the tropics, or temperate rainforests, which is just about what we're in here. These systems are working. The best designer is nature. That's all there is to it. So what we do is we look at what nature is doing. There's no sense fighting nature and plowing everything up and planting rows and rows of the same thing, which is just going to attract every pest on earth. It's better to set up these mixed systems. And if we mimic nature's ways, we see that the systems work better.
The cost of setting up a permaculture garden is relatively cheap. They were originally designed for impoverished areas of the third world. Healy says he spent about $2,000 over 8 years. He says a permaculture garden can be set up for a minimal cost.
Anybody can set this up. You'd have to get a hold of a designer to either teach you, if we do workshops, or the designer can do the design for you. He sits down, well, what do you want to have here? And then the designer designs everything around that. And once the system is set up, which is where almost all the 90% of the work is setting the system up, and that's where 90% of the money is also. Once it's set up, the system pretty much takes care of itself.
Besides the garden, permaculture also concerns itself with other areas of living, like energy efficiency, solar energy, and drinking water. Permaculture is still new to the U.S., but it's beginning to hit the mainstream. Its originator is an Australian named Bill Mollison. He's written two books on the subject, Permaculture, A Designer's Manual, and Introduction to Permaculture. Both books can be special ordered through your local bookstore or ordered from Good Earth Publications in North Carolina. Or, for general information, call 518-793-0419. That's 518-793-0419. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to The Environment Show. Let's hear from you. We're at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. You may think that a Daisy from Nashville, Tennessee, is a lady who performs at the Grand Ole Opry, but those folk are transplantable. They perform all over the world and are even cloned with impunity by copyright pirates in China. But blooming now and until mid-July in the Cedar Glades near Nashville is a flower that looks something like a daisy. It does not exist anywhere else in the world and probably never will. Standing a meter high with bright purple rays extending from a golden center, it's called the Tennessee coneflower, or Echinacea tennesseensis.
But it is one of these species that is what they call a glade endemic, or it's found only within the limestone glades of central Tennessee. Very harsh conditions for any plant to survive in. In the wintertime, these sites are inundated up to sometimes a foot of water. They're in very flooded conditions, and in the summer they're they are a desert. They'll be just baked dry, and the temperature right off the soil will be up to 120 degrees. So it gets fairly parched conditions. And these plants will occupy a very small niche between the very rocky areas of these glades and then where the forest glade starts, the forest part of the glade starts, and the very thin, shallow soils. And they occupy that little zone in there where they get just enough moisture, but nothing else can really out-compete them, so they do quite well right now.
Dave Campbell is the Director of Science and Stewardship for the Tennessee Nature Conservancy. He says the flower falls within the plant classification genus Echinacea. It has more to distinguish it than its ability to survive in Nashville. Plants in this genus were known by Native Americans for their medicinal value, and can be found in herbal remedies in health food stores today.
The genus Echinacea is what is harvested for medicinal purposes. They use the extracts from the plant for immune system boosters. This particular plant, it's really rare, so they, of course, wouldn't use it, but they use Echinacea purpurea a lot for the medicinal purposes. But if you were to take the seeds of this plant, which I have done before in the wild, to take the seeds to test their viability, you take them and you see if the seeds are, there's anything in them, and if you put them in your mouth and bite on them, they will make your mouth go completely numb within a very short period of time. So they do have a very strong chemical product inside of them. It's one of those plants that is really one of life's little treasures. It's just a real beautiful plant, and it has a very specific niche, and it's really nice to see that it still exists out there.
The flower was rediscovered in 1968 after it was thought to be extinct. As the Tennessee coneflower came into bloom this year, the United States went to the brink of a trade war with China, which is reproducing without permission a lot of copyrighted material from the country music studios of Nashville. Perhaps if we copyrighted the endangered Echinacea tennesseensis, it too would be reproduced. This technique seems far less complicated than listing the plant under the Endangered Species Act, and it could make the copyright pirates in China feel good at the same time. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 338. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goishman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Shartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. The David and Lucille Packard Foundation for support of fisheries issues, and the Bullitt Foundation. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.